know what time it is. It's time for Ask a Spaceman. I'm your host, Paul Sutter. You've got questions and I've got all the answers. You know how the show works, but let's review anew. Go online, Twitter, Facebook, hashtag Ask a Spaceman, all one word, all one hashtag. Fire away, send me questions. I'll pick them up to answer. You can also send questions to askaspaceman@gmail.com. You can also visit askaspaceman.com. That's the website that has all the episodes in the entire history. Glorious history of Ask a Spaceman. Has all the questions, has places to comment on each episode. You contact form where you can send me emails. You can do whatever you want. We have one simple... YouTube. I can't forget YouTube. Go to youtube.com/C/PaulMattSutter. Paul Matt Sutter is also my handle on Twitter and Facebook because that's my name. So it made a convenient handle. Do all that. Every single thing. Do it all. Now, we have a simple goal with this show. Complete knowledge of time and space. And on the road to today's goal, a couple questions here from Twitter at Desron94 asked, what is a nova? How does it compare to a supernova? Relatedly, Tim R. via email asked, well, white dwarves, mass, novas, what's the deal? Excellent question. See, I love these little questions like this because there are all these fascinating little corners of our universe. I mean, it's a big place. There's lots of stuff going on, which is great because it gives me plenty of topics for the podcast. It's not like I'm looking at the clock saying, oh, you know, in 3 months, we're going to cut this out because no more show, no more topics. Nope. Universe, big place, lots of stuff going on. But there's some things that hog all the attention, like black holes, wormholes, supernova. More black holes. I think I've done like 20 episodes on black holes. I don't know. I don't keep track. It feels like a lot. There's some things that people are rightly curious about because, you know, they hear about it a lot in like popular culture or you see it on the news, some news story, Big Bang questions. I get lots of Big Bang questions too. And that's great. I love all the questions, but I love like the little obscure topics like, you know, like supernova. I honestly, to be perfectly honest, I have a lot of questions in the pipe on the list about supernova. And thank you for all those questions. I swear it. I'll get around to it someday. Not today. Someday. I'm getting there. But and I can't wait to talk about supernova. Really exciting topic. But what about the underdogs? You know, what about the regular, non-super, garden variety, plain vanilla nova? I mean, how come they don't get any love? As we're going to find out, they're really super interesting and curious objects, but like, oh, you just don't get called supernova, so nobody cares about you anymore. You're just, oh, you're just a nova. You're just a new star appearing in the sky. Who cares? Who gives a rip? I give a rip. I give two rips. I'm going to give like a half hour worth of rips about regular novas. And to kind of set the stage for regular novas, which we'll just call novas from now on. We don't need to hurt their feelings saying they're regular and not super. You're super to me, novas. You're special. Anyway, to set the stage, we have to go back in time a little bit. We have to think like a pre-modern astronomer. And by pre-modern, I'm talking like pre-Renaissance era, scientific revolution, etc. astronomer. And astronomy around the world, many, many different cool traditions, various views of cosmology and how the universe is structured. Don't have time to go into that because we're doing a different show right now. But if you'd like me to talk about ancient people's views of the cosmos, I'd love to do it. So go ahead and ask. Hashtag Ask the Spaceman. But particularly in the Western, the Greco-Roman kind of tradition, we had this Aristotelian picture, you know, kind of developed by Ptolemy and Aristotle, carried through the ages, survived in the Middle Ages, etc., etc. this concept of the celestial sphere. How the Earth is at the center of the universe. Above us is the sky. Above that are various spheres that kind of nest inside of each other. And each one of these spheres carries things. Because, you know, you're looking at, from our point of view, it looks like stuff moves around, like the sun and the moon and the stars move around. So you need something to carry them. Duh. So might as, and you can't see it, it looks invisible. So it might as well be like a sphere made of crystal, because what else could it be? And so, like the sun gets its own sphere, its sphere is rotating. The moon gets its own sphere. Each planet gets their own sphere. And then at the outside edge, like the biggest sphere of all is the true celestial sphere, this the sphere that carries all the fixed stars. And in this Aristotelian view, the Earth is very different from the heavens. What's up there in space, up in the heavens, is perfect. It's 100% perfect. Like, and if you look at the motions of the planets, the motions of the star, they repeat themselves every single year. It's always the exact same thing. They never change. It looks perfect. It looks like a bunch of points of light that move in perfect harmony. While down here on Earth, things are dirty and rotten and messy and muddy and dusty and full of grief and strife. So Earth is imperfect. The heavens, the celestial realm, is perfect. And they're carried around in these spheres. Okay, that's great. That's fine, whatever. But what about, you know, comets? You know, they kind of streak through the sky. They appear for a while randomly, can't predict them, and then they go away. What's going on with that? That is a head scratcher, I'll be honest. That's a real stumper, a beard stroker, if you will. In these ancient views of cosmology, because, you know, the heavens are perfect, the Earth is imperfect, so comets look kind of imperfect, mumble, something in the atmosphere. That's it. Comets are something happening in the atmosphere. They're not up in space, they're not in the celestial realm, which is perfect. It's something weird happening in the atmosphere. Don't ask me what it is, it's just something weird, okay? Oh, and hey, okay, that's fine, whatever. We'll leave it. But what about every once in a while, like a new star pops up? You know, like we know the stars, we see them, but every once in a while we're looking at a constellation and like, there's a new star. Did we just miss it? I mean, who's in charge of keeping her? You know, was it Charles's fault again? I mean, he's supposed to keep records of this stuff. No. It's a brand new star. No, it's not Charles's fault. It's a new star that appeared. Well, what is that? Well, in this ancient view, is it a comet without a tail? I don't know. Just leave me alone. Like, okay, it's a mystery. It's just a mystery. And these kinds of things remain a mystery until the late 1500s when Tycho Brahe comes along. Tycho Brahe, perhaps one of the most interesting characters in Renaissance astronomy, perhaps all of astronomy. I know I've already introduced a few weirdos, let's be fair, weirdos in this show. Tycho Brahe is definitely up there. Got in a duel over a scientific dispute, got his nose cut off, put on a bronze one or a gold one or a metal one, had a metal nose, which is pretty awesome. They say he died because he was at a banquet and he was drinking a lot and he didn't want to get up to go to the bathroom. So his bladder burst and poisoned him from the inside out and he kind of died. That's kind of cool. What a way to go. Tycho Brahe. So he has one of the most sophisticated, if not the most sophisticated observatories in the world at this time. And he's measuring stars. He's being super accurate about it. This is before the telescope, by the way. So he's just using his eyeballs and like giant protractors or something like that. He sees a new star. There's a new star up in the sky. No one noticed it before. So, you know, the general explanation is if you see a new star, it's not really a star. It's something funny happening in the atmosphere. But Tycho Brahe knew something that like Aristotle didn't, and that's this concept of parallax, and especially parallax applied to very far things very, very far away. And parallax is super easy. I've explained it before, but that won't stop me from explaining it again. Your eyes are separated on your face by a few inches, so or a few centimeters if you go that way. Either way, your eyes are separated. So if you hold your finger up to your face and you blink left and right, your finger appears to waggle left and right. And then you put your finger further away and do the same trick. It still waggles, but not as much. And you can look at something, say, at the other side of the room. Left, right, left, right, left, right. It doesn't waggle. So you can actually use this parallax technique you can measure how far something waggles left and right to measure how far away something is. It's just math, just some high school trigonometry. Anyway, Tycho Brahe went to high school. He knew trigonometry, and he could use, instead of his left eye and his right eye, doesn't really work on the stars, you can use the Earth like in one season, say summer, and the Earth in the winter. That's two different positions. So you can look at stuff far away. And so Tycho Brahe's like measured the parallax of this quote new star. And there wasn't any parallax to measure. There was none. If there was a parallax, it was too small for him to measure with his sophisticated instruments, which means it had to be really far away. Because if it was in the atmosphere, he had the sophistication with his measuring apparatuses. If it was in the atmosphere, it'd be close enough for him to measure the wiggle left and right, to measure the parallax. But he couldn't measure it, so it means it had to be really far away. So it had to be up there with the other stars. It had to be in that celestial realm, which means the celestial sphere ain't all that perfect, is it? He found this significant enough that he wrote a book about it, about the new star. The Stella Nova, Latin, because Latin's at the time super cool to just talk and write in Latin. Still is, by the way. But that's where we get our word Nova. Nova means new. Tycho Brahe saw a new star. Lots of people before him have seen new stars, but he happened to write it down, talk about it, and argue that it was really far away. That's why his word for it gets remembered rather than someone else's. Like, of course people have seen new stars in the past. He was the first one to like really, really think about it hard. So credit where credit's due. Now, of course, nowadays, with our sophisticated 21st century understanding of the universe, we're totally cool with the concept of stuff in space is super complicated. I mean, that's like the motivation for this show, right? Is if stuff in space were simple, you wouldn't need a podcast to talk about it because it'd be like 30 seconds long. Stuff in space is really, really complicated and really messy. But that's a relatively new concept, that stuff in space can change and be messy and be complicated. For eons, everyone assumed that stuff in space was simple. And if you just look at the motions of the stars and planets, it looks simple. It looks easy. There's no hard stuff going on up there. All the hard stuff is down on Earth. But what Tycho Brahe introduced was this concept that stuff in space is complicated and it changes and it's dynamic and it's super interesting. Now, what Tycho Brahe actually saw is what we now call a supernova. But for a long time, basically anything, a new bit of light appeared in the sky, we called it a nova, whatever the mechanism for creating that new light in the sky was. So sometimes it's a brand new star appearing that no one ever saw before. And sometimes we would see an existing star suddenly ramp up its brightness to crazy high levels and then get dim again or something. But like I said, now it's the 21st century. We want to be cool. We want to get all of our facts and terms right so that you faithful listeners can represent the astronomical community out amongst all your friends and families and relatives, because I know you bore them to tears by telling them about what you heard on the Ask a Spaceman podcast. They're like, oh, not this again. Look, I understand like you're excited about space and stuff, but we don't need to talk about it over dinner. again. But, you know, I'm proud of you for that, and I want you to keep doing that. So I want you to get all the terms straight. So over the past decades, we've kind of settled on a few definitions. Supernova, which you think of as a star exploding and dying, gets to keep the word supernova. It's a nova that's super. It's pretty cool. Nova, the word nova, it's old biscuits, man. We're not doing that anymore. We're not talking about nova anymore. We don't use the word. So not only is nova like not as cool as supernova, we're not even using the word anymore. The phrase we switched out. Instead of a word that was nice and compact and easy to remember, we now have a long, complicated phrase. Cataclysmic variable star. Cataclysmic variable star. Let's break it down. Star means star. Okay, so we're starting off easy. Variable means it changes. Okay. Cataclysmic, that seems to indicate something interesting is happening. So, I can't even say this phrase. Why can't we just stick to nova? I don't know. I'm not in charge of this stuff. I'm just reporting to you, okay? Cataclysmic variable star. Something interesting happening to a star that makes it change brightness, aka a nova. So the reason the terms have changed, why there's supernova now that could today stay supernova, and nova is now this broader definition, this more complicated phrase, the reason that happened is that there's several different mechanisms for causing nova. There are several different mechanisms for making stars change their brightness. And so we wanted to kind of encompass them. Now, for those of you who are nitpicky and paying attention, there's also different mechanisms for creating supernova, but for some reason they get to keep their name as supernova, but nova don't get to keep their name of nova. I don't understand why. Like I said, not in charge. I'm just telling you the way the universe is, all right? So we've got supernova and we've got cataclysmic variable stars, CVSs. But I think CVS is taken by something else. That might be a store or something. So we're going to have to say the whole thing every time, cataclysmic variable star. And you get a point for every time you hear me mispronounce it. So you're going to get a lot of points. Now here's the deal with most novas or most cataclysmic variable stars. I said there are lots of different ways, but there's one main way. The most common way is when two stars are born together in a binary system, which is super common, by the way. Like you look on the night sky, about half the stars you're looking at are in a binary system, at least. Sometimes there'll be 3 or 4 or 8 or whatever, but binary stars, super common. Now, when they're born, they condense out clouds of gas and dust, and one star is always going to be more massive than the other because it'd be super weird. It'd be an unlikely coincidence for two stars to have the exact same mass. So just random chance, one star is going to be more massive. Now, the more massive a star is, the faster it goes through its life. I know I haven't talked about stellar lives yet, but that's the nugget, the takeaway. The more massive you are, the faster you go through life as a star. Stars like our sun will be steady burning for about 8 to 10 billion years before they turn red giant and some other nasty stuff happens, which is another show. In fact, I did a show. One of my very first episodes was on what will happen when the sun dies. So you can dig back in the archives and pull it out. Have a listen. Or I'll do another show on it. If someone wants to just ask me again, I'll repeat. I don't care. At the end of it, after a star like our sun dies, at the end of it, it leaves behind a core of carbon and oxygen that we call a white dwarf. White dwarfs start out super hot and bright because they're like the leftover core of a star, kind of warm in there. Over time, they slowly settle down, cool down, but they're relatively dense, relatively small, like say the size of the Earth or something, leftover core of the star. Now they're stable. They're not fusing. but they're not doing anything else interesting. So they're just like lumps of carbon and oxygen. They're going to hang out for trillions of years, not doing anything interesting, unless they're a part of a binary system, unless that white dwarf has a companion. And if it's a part of a binary system, one of those stars will just go through its life faster, can't avoid it. It will do its messy red giant stuff, and then it'll leave behind a white dwarf. Its companion gets to watch that whole business shake out. So it sees its companion being a normal star one day, and the next time it looks, it's bloated, red, angry, and then red giant, and then flares, and then planetary nebula formation, tons of x-rays, really sucks for a while, white dwarf. Okay, whatever. Now it's just, now instead of orbiting a star, its companion is now orbiting a white dwarf. Okay, whatever. That's life. Whatevs. And nothing much changes to the companion star as it's orbiting the white dwarf. It will change its orbit. It might get some gas stripped off during the more violent phases, but in general, pretty much the same. Until that companion star starts running towards the end of its life. Until that companion star starts turning into a red giant itself. Until that companion star starts swelling up, getting much, much larger in radius, becoming much more diffuse. And then interesting stuff starts to happen. And we got to talk about what happens when stars get fat. In general, like if a star is alone, you just have one star and it gets fat, they're still pretty much the same. They're still round. They're just bigger, but round and still lonely. But if a star is in a binary relationship, if a star is in, it has a companion, it doesn't stay so round. And that's because its companion has its own gravity. And it can pull on the star stuff, on the companion stuff, on one side of it. The side that's facing that white dwarf can be pulled a little. Just like the tides. Just like the tides. If that stuff that's kind of being pulled off the surface of the companion, you can imagine like just tugging just a little bit. If it gets too close to that white dwarf, then it kind of tips over. Instead of falling back down onto the star someday, it actually starts to get sucked onto that white dwarf. It will leave the companion star and fall onto the white dwarf. And the region where this happens in space kind of sort of looks like a teardrop. A teardrop or like a raindrop. A raindrop with the point pointing towards that white dwarf. So this companion was doing as fine as a star. It got bloated and red, started swelling up in all directions, but some of that gas starts getting funneled into that white dwarf. And this whole region is called a Roche lobe because we felt like tossing in the name of a French astronomer or something. Oh, actually, Roche like figured it out, so he's cool, and that's why. But like, you know what? We can't have an episode go by without name dropping a French astronomer. That's just how it is. Roche lobe figured it out. It looks like a lobe-ish kind of thing. It's stuff being sucked out of that red giant and pulled onto the white dwarf. If that companion star is too small or too far away, then nothing interesting happens because that gravity from that white dwarf can't actually pull on that material with any decent strength, and so nothing happens. But if that red giant gets too big and or too close, then gravity can start leaching star material from that companion, leaching, sucking down like a straw, that hydrogen and helium from the companion onto the white dwarf. Now, it doesn't, all this gas, the hydrogen and helium, it doesn't mix with the white dwarf stuff because the white dwarf stuff is heavier. It's carbon and oxygen. Instead, it just, all this hydrogen and helium just settles onto the surface. It's almost like this white dwarf is like building itself its own nice little atmosphere on top of its carbon and oxygen core it's building this hydrogen and helium atmosphere. And it's just building and building. And so as this atmosphere, this layer of hydrogen helium gets thicker, you can imagine down there at the bottom of this hydrogen atmosphere, right at the surface of the white dwarf, the pressures are starting to get a little bit high. And the temperatures are starting to get a little bit high. And you know what happens when you make the temperatures high and the pressures high? Fusion. Eventually, this white dwarf can pull enough stuff onto its surface that the bottom layer, that layer, that hydrogen atmosphere that's right up against the surface of the white dwarf can undergo nuclear fusion. Now, inside of a star, when nuclear fusion happens, the nuclear fusion itself is trying to blow up the star, but you have the gravitational pressure, the gravitational collapse of the star itself that kind of counterbalances it. So you get this teeter-totter effect. And this is what allows the fusion process to be sustained calmly for billions of years. But on the surface of a white dwarf, when you're just doing it on the surface and you get a nuclear bomb going off, there's nothing to stop it. There's nothing to counteract it. You get uncontrolled nuclear fusion, aka boom. There's nothing to stop the fusion process from settling, calming down. It just goes boom, and the whole atmosphere basically ignites. It's just the entire surface just flashes with a nuclear explosion, a nuclear detonation. Now, if that detonation is too much, if it like cracks the surface of the white dwarf, this and it just goes nuts where the carbon and oxygen in there itself starts undergoing fusion too. This is one of the ways in which we make supernova. That's much rarer because it requires a lot of oomph to get there. What tends to happen usually is that this material falls onto the white dwarf. You get a flash of fusion. All the atmosphere ignites. The white dwarf survives, and we get a regular nova, a cataclysmic variable star. It looks a lot brighter for a while. Like, usually you don't even see that white dwarf. Or maybe it's a star, a binary system that's really far away, so it's just like not visible to the naked eye. And then one day this hydrogen flash just goes off, and new star. Usually it just happens once because the shockwave rips apart the gas of the red giant, maybe ejects it from the system, or they get pushed too far away, or there's not enough gas for it to happen again. But in some cases, it can actually reoccur. And get this, it reoccurs over the course of only decades. That's right, decades. Like, think about that. Think about this incredible process, material, hydrogen, helium being pulled from a star onto the surface of a white dwarf until the pressures and temperatures reach high enough that it ignites fusion. And this can happen again and again, multiple times in a single human lifetime. Folks, when we say space is messy, we really mean it. It's really messy. It's really complicated. And these nova don't just get a little bit bright. They get like 50,000 to 100,000 times brighter. That's really bright. That's what happens when you have an entire surface of a white dwarf going off in a single nuclear explosion. That is the most common nova. There are other kinds of cataclysmic variables. For example, sometimes we'll be watching a star and it'll have a dip in brightness. It'll be dimmer for a while and then start flashing, I guess, for lack of a better term. It'll get bright, then dim, bright and dim, bright and dim, and it'll return back to its normal brightness level. Sometimes the accretion disk itself flares up, and now I'm realizing that I didn't even mention the accretion disk. As material falls from that companion star onto the white dwarf, it doesn't just like glue on like Play-Doh. The gas flows in and actually circles around the white dwarf, forming an accretion disk. Because if you're in space and you're spinning, you're probably in the shape of a disk, because that's how life is. Forms an accretion disk. Sometimes that disk itself, without the material even reaching the surface of the white dwarf, sometimes the disk itself can flare up. Sometimes you can get a helium fusion instead of just normal hydrogen fusion. This is especially common when you have two white dwarfs orbiting each other and they're like donating their atmospheres to each other. Super complicated, but fun to imagine. Sometimes magnetic fields get involved because magnetic fields always find a way of worming themselves into the physics of the universe. And so they might start twisting stuff or amplifying stuff. Sometimes two stars just straight up slam into each other. Like just over it, just like just head on collision of the stellar variety. They slam into each other. We call these luminous red nova because they're bright and they tend to be rather red. That's because they're not coming from two white dwarfs. They're coming from two stars slamming into each other. You can imagine if two stars collide, it might be brighter for a little bit. But all these different kinds get lumped together into cataclysmic variable stars, stuff in the sky changing its brightness. The most common variety is the binary, with one companion being a red giant, the other companion being a white dwarf. Both of those objects incredibly exotic and interesting, and I'd love to devote entire episodes to someday, but this episode is just about what happens when they kiss. Now, there's also the supernova, and there's lots of stuff happening in the universe. That's what's really great about it, is as we learn more about the universe, we learn how complicated, how messy, and how fascinating it really is. So thank you, Tycho Brahe, for pointing that out for us and getting this whole process started. I'd also like to thank my top Patreon contributors this month: Helgi Brokrog, Tim Fever, Justin Gelta, Justin Rolfe, Jerry, and Kevin Ogilby. I've got two Justins in the leaderboard here for Patreon, so they get the shout out. If your name is Justin, I don't want you to think that my limit is two Justins per episode. I have the capacity to thank many more Justins. So if your name is Justin and you're thinking about contributing to Ask a Spaceman, why don't you do it? And we can have the hat trick. We can have three Justins on here. Maybe you can make that happen, because my name is not Justin. And even if it was, it would make little sense for me to contribute to myself because Patreon takes a cut. So I need you, Justin, to do this. I would also accept Justina. That would also be acceptable for purposes of the hat trick. So let's do it. Let's make it happen. Patreon.com/PMSutter. PMSUTTER. You can also follow me on Twitter and Facebook. My name is Paul Matt Sutter. Keep sending me questions. Hashtag AskASpaceman. Go to the website, AskASpaceman.com. Email me at AskASpaceman@gmail.com. Thanks again to @Desron94 on Twitter and Tim R via email for the questions that led to this episode. Keep sending me questions. That's the only way we are ever going to figure out this crazy, disgusting, complicated universe, but we'll do it together. And I'll see you next time for more complete knowledge of time and space.